Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Devron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the second week of November. This week, we had planned a really great interview for you with the Pitjin-Guillemot Research Group out of Whidbey Island. Frances Wood and Govinda Rosling were going to be our guests, and they couldn't come over because of the stormy weather on the ferry, so we arranged to do a phone interview. And just as we were wrapping up the two-part phone interview, the power went out, and we lost the whole interview. They're going to be on next month instead, in December. We're going to try it again. But meanwhile, we're going to fill in with a great interview that we did with Christy Lassen from Wild Birds Unlimited up in Gardiner. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this a cool sound? It's not often heard, but if you are in the right place, you will hear it a lot. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. We have some interesting observations for last week. Kathy Knobloch of Admiralty Audubon reported seeing some interesting birds frequenting her neighborhood in uptown Port Townsend. Who knew that in the area between the courthouse and the post office, there were resident barn owls, Cooper's hawks, and sharp-shinned hawks? She and her neighbors have consistently seen these species using the area for many years now, and she also observed a scrub jay, once rare in our area but now increasingly common, hanging out near her home the last two or three weeks in October. It just goes to show that you never know what you'll see out there if you just keep your eyes open, no matter where you live.
The hunt in Dungeness for the invasive European green crab is over for the season. Resource managers report that since April, they've caught 96 green crabs on the Dungeness Spit and one in Squim Bay. They found no crabs in their surveys in October, and so have given up on the surveys for the winter. But we'll start a vigilant watch for the aggressive crabs again in April.
The Seattle Times reported some alarming preliminary findings from the fishing industry last week, showing a nosedive in Gulf of Alaska cod populations. Scientists from NOAA believe these to be linked to, quote, the blob, the huge influx of warm Pacific Ocean water that stretched during its peak in 2015 from the Gulf of Alaska to California's offshore waters. During its peak, temperatures had raised as much as 7 degrees Fahrenheit in some surface waters, with warm water spreading to depths of greater than 1,000 feet, which is likely to have had a major impact on many marine organisms. Even though the warm water blob has now largely broken up, it is considered a likely preview of ocean temperatures expected later this century as climate change intensifies.
On a more positive note, it's been a great week for orca sightings, with OrcaNet reporting a lot of activity throughout our region. Fairly large groups of orca, up to 15 members strong, were seen by several people in several different areas around the Puget Sound. These sightings were of both the salmon-eating resident whales and the mammal-eating bigs or transient orca. It is unusual to have both types occupying Puget Sound waters, sometimes in pretty close proximity to one another, for several days at the same time.
Bottlenose dolphins have been reported nearly daily, mostly in pairs of late. Confirmed reports of bottlenose are interspersed with unidentified dolphins seen in larger pods, who may be additional bottlenose, or some of the remaining common dolphins who came inland to Puget Sound in June of 2016.
And as an additional bonus, a sea otter was observed amongst the kelp off South Lopez. Our thanks to OrcaNetwork.org for all of this news. Go to their website to see some great photos posted of our recent orca visitors.
It's always such a pleasure to have Christy Lassen on our show, sharing about various aspects of bird biology. For this show, Christy suggested that we speak about backyard hawks, since one of the advantages of winter is that it's easier to spot some of our more common hawks, as their perching spots are more exposed with all the leaves gone from many of the trees and shrubs. And we are blessed with lots of different species of birds of prey in our area. That includes eagles, owls, vultures, kites, and falcons. But what loosely describes a hawk? We're not talking seahawk here, just to be clear.
The characteristics that make a hawk are primarily that they are diurnal birds of prey, that they are daytime hunters. The other characteristics are that they hunt on the wing and take their prey by surprise. And while I was looking this up, when I looked up what makes a hawk, something interesting that
It's not really an easy question. I mean, yeah, because there's so many general terms
variations
that get tossed about.
In there too. Yeah. Well, one of the things that I saw that I thought was kind of interesting is that there are dragonflies that they call hawks
They
are daytime hunters, just like our birds of prey.
Yeah, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yes. And I do think that the seahawk is probably based on an osprey.
Yes,
I think osprey is our seahawk.
Think that's very true. So the hawks in our area are generally broken up into two major categories, right? The occipiters and the buteos.
Yes. Essentially, buteos are more birds of open spaces. They're the birds that are largely, but not exclusively, ones that feed on ground animals. Their bodies are adapted to use thermals to soar on. They have long, broad wings, and they have relatively short tails. Our most common buteo here is the red-tailed hawk. Golden eagles and bald eagles are buteos too.
You just don't think about that. You think of eagles as completely separate.
They're part of that family. There's so many different categories in there too. It's an interesting thing to look at. Swainson's hawks and Ferruginous hawks are not native species to us here on the peninsula, but they are birds that both of our rehab centers have as educational birds.
They're common, like back east.
They are. Well, common back east, even in eastern Washington, the open plains sort of areas, more for those guys. Both of our rehab centers have these two birds that you can get a really up close
and
great look at
beautiful.
During their programs.
Yeah.
So the occipiters, which is the other main category, are the fast flyers of the raptor world. They have short, rounded wings and relatively long tails, and their bodies are adapted to chase birds through tight spaces like brush and tree branches. Our occipiters here are the sharp-shinned hawks, the Cooper's hawks, and the little less common goshawk.
Those two species cause more confusion in our area than anything else, right?
The Cooper's and the sharp-shinned, definitely.
They're really hard to tell apart.
They are hard to tell apart. The Cooper's hawk and the sharp-shinned are very similar. They have similar characteristics and similar habits. But there's some very distinctive differences in them. The first being the size of the birds.
And part of that is due to the fact that raptors across the board have size differences. I mean, between sexes.
Definitely.
Yeah, the females are generally...
It's about 25%
larger than the males. That's a complicating factor.
That does add in the plot twist of how to tell what's what of what you're looking at. But like two kind of, I guess you'd say, the main thing to look for if you're trying to tell if it's a Cooper's hawk or a sharp-shinned hawk. The sharp-shins are similar in size to a jay or a dove. They average about 10 to 14 inches long. The Cooper's hawk are similar in size to that of a crow. They average about 14 to 20 inches long. And then you get that little overlap. If you're looking at a female sharp-shin, she's just about the same size as a male Cooper's adults are. So there's a couple of other little tricks that you can do to kind of help you tell these two apart. The tail tips of these birds are defining in which one is which. It's one of the most easily noticed differences between these two species. Sharp-shinned hawks' tails are squared off when they're sitting at rest. So it's a very square shape. And their outer feathers are slightly longer, and there's a little small cleft in the middle of it. So it has a little dip right in the middle of the tail, that square tail. And it has a thin white tip. The Cooper's hawk, his tail at rest is rounded in shape, and it has a large white tip on the bottom of it. So those are helpful if they're sitting. If they're flying, it's not quite as easy to tell. Legs are also a defining characteristic in both of these. The sharp-shinned, he pretty much gets his name from the way his legs look. He has long, thin, pencil-like legs that have pretty much a sharp-shin on them. And the Cooper's hawk has short, thick legs. So those are some things that can help you sort of tell the difference between the two.
Yeah, those are really good things to look out for. But something else that people don't always realize is the fact that immature birds often look very different from the adults. Even though they're fully fledged, they're as large as the adults, but they look way different.
Definitely. There's different colorations and different patterns on their feathers. in the juveniles and the adults. Adult Sharpshins and Cooper's Hawks have dark gray backs and rusty barring that is more horizontal on their breasts, and they have very distinct red eyes. The adults, this species, that eye is one of the first things that I look at always to see if it's in a juvenile or an adult.
Well, and people think, oh, that's just so esoteric. I'll never see that. But you do. Yeah, I mean, it really stands out. Yeah.
Definitely. So juvenile Sharpshins and Cooper's Hawk both have yellow eyes. They have dark brown vertical stripes on their breasts and brown backs and heads, usually with a little bit of white spotting too. And if you can see the front of the hawk, if it's a juvenile hawk, to try and help you tell the difference between the Coopers and the Sharpshins hawk have very thick rufous stripes that extend down the lower belly. And then the Cooper's hawk have these thin dark streaks that fade away onto the lower belly to kind of help tell you the difference between the two species too.
Do both Sharpshin and Cooper's hawks have the same home range in both summer and winter in our area?
Here on the peninsula, they are year-round residents. They may move a little bit around in the habitat, but they stay here on the peninsula. They don't migrate.
And they mostly prey on birds all year round?
These two species, yes. They are the songbird hunters. And they get a lot of flack for that, too. They kind of get a bad rap at people's bird feeders.
I know. People are just all about the songbirds, and they think, oh, that bad Sharpie or Cooper's.
I can say I have those feelings at times as well. But it's all part of the circle of life. The hawks in your backyard at your bird feeder are the checks and balance of your habitat. To have one at your feeder means that your habitat is in balance. That hawk is going to keep your bird population healthy and happy.
And they're not the only birds that take advantage of bird feeders. I mean, my neighbor, Jamie Rudink, was telling me about watching a great blue heron pluck a bird off the bird feeder. I was just so shocked. I had no idea that they did that.
They're meat eaters. The herons are. They're kind of...
They eat.
They're
opportunists.
I actually saw one eat a vole the other day. So
wow.
They will eat lots of things. Yes.
They're quite remarkable. But back to hawks. The northern goshawk is another hawk that's closely related to Sharpshin and Cooper's, right?
In the same family of accipiters, immature goshawks and Cooper's hawks are very similar. However, the goshawks are much more uncommon for us. The immature goshawk is heavily streaked like a Cooper's, but he's much bigger in size. Goshawks are comparable in size to red-tail hawks. The habitat that they prefer is old-growth forests, and that's one of the reasons why I think that they're more uncommon, because we have less and less old-growth forest out here in our area. Northern goshawks are secretive birds, and they typically live in large tracts of forest, so they are hard to find out there. They don't typically occur in populated areas, so any hawk that you see in your backyard is more likely to be a Cooper's than a goshawk. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology says that your best chance of finding a northern goshawk is to spend time in mature forests, being as quiet, observant, and patient as possible. And I think one of the reasons these birds really like these old-growth forest areas is because they build and maintain up to 8 alternate nests within their nesting areas.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're industrious. They like to build lots of nests in case one of them fails or falls out of the tree or something happens to it, and they can move to another nesting site.
Yeah, that's good planning. I spend a lot of time working in old forests, and I used to see and hear goshawks a lot more often than I do now. And it's worrying to me. I would like to see a study done specifically on them and whether their population is declining on the Olympic Peninsula.
There are studies being done on goshawk populations. The North American Breeding Bird Survey indicates that populations on our entire continent have declined about 21% between 1966 and 2014. There's another organization studying them too called Partners in Flight, which estimates that the global breeding population of the goshawks is at 400,000 birds, which seems like a lot, but for our whole continent, that's not a very large number. Today, the biggest threat to breeding goshawks is really timber harvest. The goshawks depend on mature trees and forests with relatively intact canopies for nesting and for foraging. Nesting birds are sensitive to logging activities such as building roads and loading and skidding felled trees. And the U.S. Forest Service has included the goshawks now on its sensitive species list for many regions. This requires that proposed management activities, such as logging, consider potential impacts on goshawks. So hopefully we can see a resurgence in their numbers. That would be really good.
I would hope for that as well. So the other common medium-sized hawk that we have neglected to mention thus far is the northern harrier, which used to be called the marsh hawk, and I still think it should be called. What caused the name change there?
I love northern harriers. I think they're a gorgeous bird, and while I was reading up on them, I found something interesting just kind of to the side is that they
we
should
always
be
like
there.
Those aside.
I read that the northern harriers should be in their own classification of birds of prey called circus, which is, as the name suggests, that they tend to circle low over open marsh country to catch their prey. And I did do a little digging, too, on why they changed the name from marsh hawk to northern harrier. And I found a really interesting, very funnily written article from a man named Mike O'Connor. He owns a Birdwatchers General Store on Cape Cod, and he helped explain the change. And here's the gist of it. In 1982, the American Ornithological Union decided that we should start calling marsh hawks northern harriers. The AOU, which is the American Ornithological Union, which is a union that helps promote birds, not give them more coffee breaks, works hard to ensure common bird names are fitting and consistent. They wanted everyone in the country to refer to a particular bird using the same name. And sometimes these names...
And that would be a struggle.
Yes, definitely. Sometimes these names changes are based on new scientific evidence, and other times they're due to public pressure. There's an example that's kind of fun to just show you. In 2003, for example, the rock dove, which was kind of commonly known as our city park pigeon, was officially changed to rock pigeon. The AOU finally realized that no matter how hard they tried to convince people, no one was ever going to call a pigeon a dove. And sometimes a new name is actually an improvement. The peregrine falcon was called by the name of Duck Hawk, which kind of sounds like a villain in a comic book.
They were considered villains to duck hunters, probably.
Possibly, yes. They were big-time duck eaters. In 1973... they changed the name of Pigeon Hawk, and instead it was awarded one of the best names in the world, which is the Merlin.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So that's an upgrade, too. But, like, the Marsh Hawk, the original name is different for that bird because it fits. This bird is a marsh dweller. It eats, it sleeps, it breeds in marshes. If you see a bird that's slowly and methodically flying up just above a marsh or a grassland, you can pretty much bet it's a marsh hawk. So why did they change the name? Sometimes officials do things that defy logic, but this move isn't as crazy as it seems. There are about a dozen different species of harriers found throughout the world, and the marsh hawk just happens to be one of them. So they changed the name, and because they didn't want this one harrier to have a non-harrier name, basically.
Uh-huh. So it's more a way of grouping it with rest of its family members than helping us distinguish what it is.
So in 1982, that's when they changed marsh hawk to northern harrier.
Aha. Uh-huh.
The northern harrier is distinctive from a long distance away. He is a slim, long-tailed hawk gliding low over marshes or grassland, holding its wings in a V shape. Harriers have a white patch at the base of its tail and a distinctive black bar along the inside edge of their wings. Up close, it has a very owlish, dish-shaped face that helps it hear mice and voles scurrying around under the vegetation.
Because it has a different technique than a lot of hawks do of hunting, right? It's hunting more with its ears
with
than
sound.
It is with its eyes. And it looks a little bit like a short-eared owl than when it's hunting. Thanks so much for being with us, Christy.
Thanks for having me.
And we have some great upcoming natural history events to tell you about. If you need a little warm weather escapism during this week of stormy weather, join Admiralty Audubon for a slideshow on the birds of Hawaii. Come to the Port Townsend Community Center at 7 p.m. on Thursday, November 16th. Go to admiraltyaudubon.org for more details.
The Olympic Peninsula Audubon chapter up in Squim, meanwhile, is offering several special events, starting with their holiday Nature Mart at the Dungeness River Audubon Center. Festivities start at 10 a.m. on Friday, November 17th, and continue through Saturday, November 18th at 4 p.m. There will be a special lighting of the bridge at the Railroad Bridge Park on Friday evening. On Saturday morning, the 18th, there is also a field trip to look for birds from Pitcher Pocket to Port Williams. Go to their website at olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for more information.
The Olympic chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society is also hosting their monthly meeting next Tuesday, November 21st, which features Olympic National Park's lead botanist, Janet Coles, talking about the response of the Queets River Valley's flora to the 2015 Paradise Fire. This fire burned for 5 months in mostly wilderness areas, consuming nearly 3,000 acres of rainforest. Come to the Port Townsend Community Center starting at 6:30 for social time, with the program starting at 7 p.m. And here's our mystery sound again. That is the call of a merlin, but you don't hear it very often. I mean, they're just so darn stealthy that you only hear it when there's a pair and they're breeding and they're nattering back and forth. And I long to hear them.
It's their love song.
Yeah, like yeah. This. So, yeah. Christy, why don't you tell us a little bit about merlins?
Merlins are really cool little birds. They are small, fierce falcons. They use surprise attack to catch their prey, which is mostly songbirds or shorebirds. They're very powerful flyers, and you can tell them from the larger falcons by their rapid wing beats and overall dark tones. Merlin populations have largely recovered from 20th century declines, thanks to the ban on the pesticide DDT and their availability to adapt to life around towns and cities. While I was researching merlins, I found some really cool, interesting facts about them. Merlins have been seen hunting cooperatively in pairs. They hunt large flocks of birds like cedar waxwings or robins that flock together tightly in bushes. And one merlin will swing from underneath up through the bush and startle all of the birds out of the bush. And then the partner will come and hit a bird as they burst out of the bushes.
Wow, that's cool.
So they hunt cooperatively, which is pretty neat. Merlins tend not to build their own nests. Instead, they take over the old nests of other raptors or crows, and they were our ones that were called the pigeon hawks, but merlin's definitely a better name for them. They were called pigeon hawks because in flight they look somewhat pigeon-like.
Because they have those tucked wings.
Yes, their wings kind of tuck back in when they're flying. Yep.
Well, and I have been hearing that the populations have been coming back a bit in our area. They don't normally breed here, but we'll get them as winter visitors sometimes, or we'll see them in migration. But the incidence of seeing them has been increasing somewhat. A friend of mine, Fred Sharp, saw some at Port Ludlow, saw a pair this year. And he was saying that one of the best places on the peninsula to see them is down at Lake Quinault.
Very nice. It's a gorgeous place to go and see birds.
Yes, indeed it is. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the second week of November. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you've missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always, happy trails!
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music is I See Hawks in L.A., performed by the group I See Hawks in L.A.
Hawks in L.A. I see hawks in L.A. If you see hawks, then maybe we should talk. I see hawks in L.A. I hear trains in the night. I hear trains in the night. Lonesome sound, lonesome as this town. I hear trains in the night. Thank you. more days.